Monster Man, special episode, Chronopia. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Justin. If you'd like to be like Justin and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to all the rewards for lower levels, including monthly bonus content and all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Justin, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy today's episode. Also, because we are between regular seasons of Monster Man, I'm now going to be thanking new patrons on special episodes, which I previously would only do on regular episodes, but since there are no regular episodes at the moment, I feel a bit unfair not to thank them. So thank you very much to new Patreon backer, John Hartwell. All right, Justin has asked me to talk about the monsters of Chronopia. So let's start by establishing what that is. There was a period in the 1990s where it seemed like what every company wanted was a Warhammer killer. And that included established miniatures companies like Grenadier, which tried to unseat the big fella with Fantasy Warriors, or FASA, which had Vor the Maelstrom, I-Corps had Void, even White Wolf had a miniatures game, Trinity Battleground, which actually had some pretty nice figures, although I never played the game. One contender in this field was Swedish company Target Games, which in partnership with miniatures manufacturer Heartbreaker, had a sci-fi game, Warzone, and a fantasy game, Chronopia. You may have noticed, but none of these had much effect on Warhammer. So, released in 1997, Chronopia was a spin-off of the popular Swedish RPG Dragons and Demons, which had been through several editions in the 1980s before a release in 1994 that included the Chronopia setting. DOD, which, if you hadn't guessed, is Sweden's answer to Dungeons and Dragons, is an interesting subject and not one that I know very much about. I do know that it is a name with some brand recognition in Sweden, and my understanding is that Chronopia, you know, insofar as it has a following today, like more in Europe and less in the English-speaking world. I may have been quite representative in that sense, because I was pretty into Warzone in the 90s, but I didn't play Chronopia. Though I have some friends who did, and I have more who collected the models but never really played the game. Chronopia, I would say, has a little bit of a cult following, but it didn't really make a big splash, and the problem is that making these kinds of games is very expensive. And so I think Target struggled, and I believe went out of business not long after, in the late 90s, and then the line got picked up by other companies that just didn't have the resources necessary to support the game with enough releases to keep people interested. That's my very casual look at what happened. So that's the history of the game. What about the setting? The Chronopia setting, like many fantasy worlds of the time period, was based on inverting some of the common tropes of fantasy and was heavily committed to a particular aesthetic. My point about the artist is simply that Chronopia does have a pretty unified visual aesthetic, very 40k-ish with big shoulder pads and stuff, but a lot more kind of like angular forms. It's actually quite an interesting look, although I don't know that all the miniatures, particularly in the later period, really nailed the execution. You could say the same thing about late Warzone. So, we've got the Firstborn. The Firstborn are humans. They once lived as a subject people to the Triad, right? So the alliance of elves, dwarves, and sort of orcs and whatever. But now that their leader, the One King, has returned, I believe he was reincarnated, they're on the up again, and they are very kind of like, you know, they have long flowing robes and like big shoulder pads and big stylized helmets. Unlike, well, mostly unlike the other humans in the setting, the Sons of Kronos, who are kind of barbarian-y types and on-again, off-again allies of the Firstborn. You've also got the elves, who are your basic elves. You know, philosophy, sorcery, also long robes. Cronopia's elves are very aesthetically distinct from what you might think of as an elf. Again, lots of those, like, big, chunky, angular forms. Interesting, not what you would normally think of as an elf, right? They're not delicate. Nothing's delicate in Cronopia. Then you got your dwarves, divided into rival clans, each with a kind of animal theme, and they are ruled, by incarnations of their gods called blood totems, which I'll talk about a little bit more later on. You got the Black Bloods, who are your orcs, goblins, trolls, and whatever, and they are very sort of civilized and refined, right? They're not barbarians, and they are kind of sort of Arabian Nights themed, I guess. Lots of pointy helms and headscarves and long flowing robes. I'm not saying that there are a lot of long flowing robes because somebody didn't like sculpting knees, but, you know, maybe. Then you got the Devout, who are demon-summoning necromantic baddies who were once servants of the One King, but got corrupted and evil or, like, envied his power or whatever and betrayed him. And now they have, like, armies of the undead and demons and stuff. There was a supplement released that included two more factions. You have the Stygians, who are sort of snaky, alien-y kind of guys. They reminded me a little bit of early versions of the Corallon from Void. Although not exactly, but there were lots of, like, snake lower body, more humanoid upper body models, I suppose. And then you have the Swamp Goblins, who are goblins that live in swamps. Now, some of these armies don't have much in the way of monsters, but some do, and I've picked out three examples of monsters from the Cronopia setting that I thought would be fun to discuss. We'll start with by far my favorite monsters in the whole setting, the Dwarven Blood Totems. So, like I said, the dwarves are divided into different clans, and these clans have been in and out of various alliances over the setting's history, including having one clan that betrayed the others, and one clan that got wiped out. So, at one point, the dwarves were involved in a hasty alliance to fight against the Devout when the Devout first turned up. And to neutralize the dwarf threat, the Devout unleashed a curse on them. So, the Jackal clan, who are kind of the bad guy dwarves, having been defeated by the other dwarven clans, they decided to turn on the other dwarven clans. They turned to the side of the Dark One, the leader of the Devout, and they unleashed a thing called the Wilding, which is basically an evil spell, a curse that was going to destroy the dwarven gods. The gods lived among the dwarven community, like they were there, by this point, the Dwarven Gods were no longer what they once were. They had once been these incredibly powerful beings, but now they were sort of weakening in a new age that had less time for gods. And in order to protect the dwarves, they sacrificed themselves. They absorbed the energy of the curse into themselves. So the dwarves were saved, but the gods were horribly mutated into these mindless, bestial beings. And they actually became a huge threat to the dwarves. They were rampaging around the dwarven cities or ring holds, wreaking havoc on their own people. This dwarven hero, who's kind of like the major figure of modern dwarven history in the game, figures out how to tame these creatures, these blood totems, as they're called, and assigns each of them a special officer called a keeper to look after him. Also, the dwarves get this kind of like animalistic thing that, you know, goes with their totems. They remind me of the sort of animal helms in the Hawkmoon stories by Michael Moorcock, where they've got the animal like masks. Anyway, the blood totems are now like this weapon in the dwarven armies, where they actually have figured out how to tame these things. The keepers can look after them, and the totems come out and are just like rampaging monstrosities, and they're great. They're hulking bestial creatures, and they kind of are reflected in the designs of the dwarves themselves. The dwarves, quite apart from the blood totems, I think are my favorite Cronopia miniatures. They're sort of stocky bodies and animalistic face masks turn some of the defects of the line sculpting style into good points, right? They look weird to begin with. They're not meant to be, you know, humans are not meant to be realistically proportioned. They look kind of alien and goofy, but that's sort of a good thing. And you know me, I mean, these creatures combine several of my specific interests: bone-crunching brutality, cool masks, once noble beings turned into monsters. Oh, and boars. You know I love a boar monster. So one of these dwarven blood totems, the Dark Tusk blood totem, is a great big boar. Well, boar being boar person, I guess. And, you know, when I got finished researching this episode, I actually started window shopping for the Dark Tusk blood totem. You know, see if I can find it at a good price, because I might pick one up. Like a boar monster. It's kind of a thing I like. But I like the blood totems. I like their tragic backstory. I like the idea of the gods sacrificing themselves and effectively being turned into monsters. I think in an RPG, you would want that to be something that the player characters would discover in play. So you would think the gods were all killed and they were replaced. You know, these monstrosities must have killed the gods. But no, actually they are the gods, and this was their sacrifice. You know, not just to be destroyed, but to be turned into monsters. Because even then, they could still continue to serve their people in some way. Speaking of miniatures that I might pick up if I see one at a good price, the demons that work for the Devout are also pretty cool. So the Devout are your basic evil cult types, right? And this being Sweden in the 1990s, they're dripping with metal attitude. You've got these devout necromancers who are referred to in the text of the rulebook as the Lords of the Seven Gates of Hell, which, you know, is pretty great. This inner circle of weird former disciples of the One King, supported by legions of evil sorcerers and reanimated corpses and crazy monsters and, like, cult fanatics. So you do have some of these human units that just kind of look like darker clad versions of the Firstborn. And you also have the Risen, who are your, you know, skeleton warriors. But for me, the standouts of the Devout Army are the big models, the demons, which include the Tormented, the Abyss Crawler, the Soul Flayer, and more. Now, one of the interesting things about monsters that come from miniature war games is that they're often, what they are, their nature, is often determined by material factors or other limitations that have to do with the way the models are produced. Now, I know that I have listeners to this show who are sculptors or who are miniature manufacturers, and they obviously know a lot more about this than I do. But from a consumer's perspective, I remember the 1990s being the time that you started to get more companies producing things in resin. Resin figures were quite rare, like person-sized figures, but big monsters were just kind of starting to happen. Grendel did some, and I think Heartbreaker were, you know, kind of one of the first companies to really go after resin in a big way for things that weren't like buildings or vehicles. Now, what has changed, I don't know, in terms of the technology or the materials being used. I know there are different types of resin that have different qualities in terms of their casting, but it was pretty commonplace at that time for resin monster models to be kind of single-piece castings, or, you know, castings that had, like, multiple parts that you would stick together, but it was not uncommon to have a monster where, like, the legs were really, like, flush against the body, or it was, you know, standing with its legs together so that it was just a single shape with surface detail, or even the arms up against the body. And these bigger monsters in the Devout army, I think, are resin pieces. And what that means is that the design of them is often quite, like, blocky and solid. They're often kind of low slung. Not all of them. Some of them are more upright than others. There are ones that are clearly, like, multi-part. So, for instance, the Soul Flayer's wings are obviously separate pieces. But I think that's to do with the way that the miniatures were made and cast at the time, although I couldn't tell you the exact details of it. And I think that you can see that if you look both at the Abyss Crawler and the Tormented. The Tormented in particular is the one that I want to focus on. It is a creepy demon that doesn't really have a lower body, right? It's kind of dragging its upper body along the ground on its big buff arms. And the background of it is that this is a creature that is suffering, right? It's the Tormented. It is being tortured by the Dark Lord. And it is terrifying as much because of what it represents about what the Dark Lord might do to you as the harm that it can cause. But it also says that this creature is only relieved of its suffering when it's killing and destroying. So it actually feels a little bit better when it's on the rampage, and consequently, it's on the rampage a lot of the time. but there's just something very weird about the Tormented's appearance of kind of stumpy solidity. The Soul Flayer is another example of this, and again, I don't know if it's something to do with the way that the casting is done, but it's also sculpted in quite a, like, it's like hunched over. So I just think there's something interesting about the way that these models are influenced by, I think, by the physical constraints of their design that gives them a certain kind of look that you don't see in the era of plastic miniatures or even of modern resin miniatures. Even big resin pieces don't have that quality anymore. I don't know what the difference is, but they don't. They're more dynamic, more like their plastic and metal counterparts. Finally, I want to talk about mounts and whatnot. So, you know, one role of monsters in a fantasy war game is to give other creatures something to ride. And one thing that a lot of games feature, and Chronopia is no exception, is a thing that I'm very fond of, which is a lot of little guys on a big guy. Now, Heartbreaker doesn't do the best one of these, which is the Barbarian War Rhino from Grenadier. The bunch of barbarians hanging off the side of a charging woolly rhinoceros. Amazing. That's maybe a treat for a special celebration, because I think it's quite a pricey model. Anyway, but the equivalent here, although it's much smaller, would be the Black Blood Goblin Myrmidon, which is like a big kind of elephant-y, pachydermy kind of creature being ridden by a squad of goblins armed with bows and long pikes. Love that stuff. I love a bunch of little guys on the back of a big guy. But although the Black Blood Myrmidon is pretty cool, it is not my favorite of the Chronopia mounts. Those ones are probably... Well, actually, I should mention that honorable mention goes to the dwarves, who do have some guys riding bighorn sheep, like 20 years before Peter Jackson put it in his movie. People keep saying they're goats in the Hobbit movies, and I do think they're bighorn sheep. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Point is, even though I like those, the winner for me are the drone riders from the Swamp Goblins army. And the drones are basically kind of mosquito-y, waspy, you know, buzzy flying insects. And then there's these little guys on their back armed with, you know, cane lances and blowpipes and things. And I think that's great. Quite apart from the visceral response to the idea of this, you know, buzzing creature coming at you while a guy on the back shoots at you with his blowpipe, they represent something of the kind of personality of the army. So if you look at the devout or the firstborn or even the elves and definitely the dwarves, there's a lot of like, and the blackbloods for that matter, there's a lot of hulking armored brutes. And the swamp goblins are very much not that. They're nimble little guys. And to zip around on a wasp while, you know, the other guys are charging at you on like a dinosaur or whatever, I think really summarizes the hit-and-run, stealthy, speedy approach that the swamp goblins are supposed to take, right? Like, they float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. You know, it's in keeping with the whole vibe of the army, and I like that. There are also more grounded... I don't want to say that it's all, like, ambushes and whatnot, but definitely the little guy underdog style of the swamp goblins is something I like. I also feel like the goblin drone riders are, or drone warriors I think they're called, are maybe the easiest Chronopia monsters to work into a regular fantasy RPG encounter, right? It's just little stinkers riding giant wasps in a swamp. What's not to like? Now, I know in the past I've said I'm not too excited about either the Hornet Comet Giant or the Wasp Comet Giant, because I don't know that they get that much scarier when they're above a certain size. Like those huge hornets that everybody was so terrified of some years ago, like those are pretty scary, but I don't know that they'd be that much scarier if they were 10 times bigger. They're big enough that you can't just swat them, and beyond that it might just be overkill, but I don't know, I think they're cool. I like the idea. I think if you're going to use them in an RPG, you wouldn't necessarily make them as big as they are, which is just a necessity to do with, you know, the way that the miniatures are sculpted and manufactured. I think if it was wee little guys and not just sort of, you know, goblins who are short, but not like sleep in a drawer short, you could make it work. So to wrap up, monsters from miniatures games are subject to a different set of design decisions and a different set of constraints than monsters in fantasy role-playing game. Now, this is assuming you have a game like Chronopia where, you know, you have a line of miniatures for that game. Obviously, in game terms, if you look at something like, I don't know, Dragon Rampant, where a dragon or a Mumak or, you know, presumably a goblin Myrmidon is just a greater war beast. They're all just greater war beasts with various optional rules for their fiery breath or flying or whatever. That's a different story. But I mean, in cases where, you know, what's in the army is being driven by the miniatures line, there are these different constraints on how things are designed. And that doesn't mean that you can't take monsters from these games and then, like, use them in a fantasy RPG. But it does mean that there are some cases where it isn't so easy. So, for example, if you look at a typical game of Age of Sigmar, is going to be full of, like, big monsters that are there to fight a regiment of troops. And they're just not really going to be good everyday antagonists for a fantasy RPG because they're designed, literally, to operate at a different scale. But games like Chronopia, I think, in particular, provide lots of useful visual inspiration. Like, if you ever see the rulebook for a game like Chronopia or Cryomech or one of the many other never-really-landed miniatures games of the 90s and 2000s, you know, I found the copy of Cryomech that I have for, you know, £4 in a bargain bin at a games convention. And, you know, if you find that, I think they can be fun to read through. There's a lot of interesting backstory. The Chronopia history and, like, world description sections are a fantastic reminder of just how over the top it was normal to be in the late 1990s. They do kind of make that game background mistake of starting, you know, 10,000 years ago in the Age of the Sundering or whatever. But still, those are some of the monsters from Chronopia that I especially like, and I kind of have a couple of them on my shopping list now. All right, that is about all the Chronopia monsters I've got time to talk about today. So, Justin, thank you once again very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, don't forget that if you'd like to be like Justin and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we are returning to the theoretical, as Patreon backer Luke asks us, how do you keep unique monsters, you know, unique? So I hope that you will join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram @MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.